Good evening, everybody. This event is about new technologies, so if you would, anyone who's got a mobile phone on, please switch it off, because it may be the source of this annoying buzz. If it isn't, we're trying to check what the annoying buzz is and hope to cure it fairly soon. My name is Anthony Goodens, director of the LSE. It's a great pleasure to welcome this vast audience here this evening, and particularly a pleasure to welcome our most distinguished guest, sitting with his back to me, but his front to you, Manuel Castells, who I'm very pleased that well, you've actually heard of him. It's great. I'm very pleased that Manuel has chosen the LSE as the platform to launch his new book, The Internet Galaxy. Manuel and I have been, as it were, intellectual comrades for quite a long while. We had a two-day public debate in Madrid quite recently, an extraordinarily intense intellectual event. That was about Manuel's famous trilogy that everyone here, I'm sure, will know about the Network Society. This book is a follow-up to that work. When you think of the internet, many people think of something which came and went, I think. And if that is how you think, I would recommend to you not only Manuel's book, but a book published about a year and a half ago by Michael Mandel called The Coming Internet Depression, in which he quite accurately anticipated some of the things that have happened to the dot-com business and to people's perception of the internet more generally. He published this book well before the internet depression happened, so it was a major event of social science prediction. What he said was that the very mechanisms that propelled the dot-com economy to such prominence would bring it down equally quickly. The preeminence of venture capital, highly mobile labor forces, very, very rapid technological change. Mandel said when all these things became, as it were, negative, you would get a tremendous downward spiral of internet-linked companies. And he said something very interesting. I just checked it recently this afternoon, in which he said that at that point, and we've got to that point, I think, he said many people would think that the whole internet phenomenon was a mirage, that it was all just something which came and went. And at the end of his book, he says, no, the internet has transformed our life. The internet will continue to transform our life. And I believe this conclusion to be entirely right and correct. So far as the internet goes, what we've seen, I think, really is one step backwards, two step forwards. The internet will still continue to be a fundamental transformative vehicle for our personal lives, for communication, and for the larger society. Well, we've got a very distinguished panel here to discuss these issues. And, of course, we've got the star performer, Manuel Castells himself. Manuel is going to talk initially from the lectern for about 15 minutes. And then our other all-star contributors are going to speak for 10 minutes each. And then Manuel will reply. And then, hopefully, if everyone sticks to their discipline, there will be a certain amount of time for audience participation. But, of course, you can send in your participation electronically afterwards, should you choose to do so. On the panel we have John Norton, who is the leader of the Going Digital Project at the Open University and fellow of Walsham College, Cambridge. You're going to put up your hand. That's good. And we've got Jeff Mulgan, who is the director of Forward Strategy Unit at number 10 Downing Street and the Performance and Innovation Unit in the Cabinet Office. Sorry, I jumbled it up slightly. We've got our own, very own Roger Silverstone at the end there, Professor of Media and Communications at the LSE. We have David Warlock, who is the Chairman of Electronic Publishing Services. And we've got, again, our very own Robin Mansell, who is the first incumbent of the Dixon Chair in New Media and Internet Studies. Remind you at this point, if you haven't read your LSE events leaflet, that this tonight's event is one of two linked events. Please come back for the second one, which Robin Mansell is going to give the lead lecture. And Manuel, you're coming for that as well. So the discussion today will be continued tomorrow. It'll be equally high-powered tomorrow. So please, again, welcome the panel, and I'll turn to Manuel to make the introductory statement.
Thank you very much, Tony, friend and colleague for a long time. I also want to thank all of you for your interest and for being here. And I will try to briefly share some of the elements of my analysis to submit it to your reaction and to your use. I also want to thank the London School of Economics and Robin Mansell for having taken the initiative of this launching, and certainly my publisher, Oxford University Press, and particularly David Masson, who as commissioner and editor is really materially responsible for convincing me to write the book after I have decided already not to write books for a long, long time after my trilogy. At least this is a short book, which you can see people improve and learn over their life. I also want to thank Philip Henderson and Colleen Hadjik, Oxford University Press, for all the work they have done to prepare this event. We are having this event in what I would consider personally to be very dark moments.
Maybe the mic isn't working. It's all about technology, this whole thing, and none of it ever works.
Probably it's like in California. We have lots of electronics but no electricity.
Can you tell us at the back if you still can't hear
when Manuel starts?
Okay. I think it's all right now. Thank you very much for your remarks, because then we can communicate. So just simply a personal statement that I think we are living in very dark moments, and could be even darker soon. But life goes on, and I think in these moments is when we more than ever need some serious analysis, scholarly analysis, cold analysis, and scientific research more than ever, so that we are not going to be submerged by emotions, but still call upon reason to act upon this world. What is this book about? I think when it was conceived, it was swimming against the stream, swimming upstream, against all the ideas about the new generation, about the internet, the new age, etc., etc. All the things that you have heard from the media and from a whole series of futurologists, consultants, and even I would say politicians suddenly converted to high technology. And when published now, it is still swimming against the stream, but this time is swimming downstream against the reflux of what appeared to be a tidal wave that no one could stop. So the basic approach here in this book is to try to assess as rigorously as possible and think about the internet on the basis of what we know, not on the basis of what will be that we don't know, at least I don't, or on the basis of what could have been or what must be. It's on the basis of what it is. And therefore, on this basis, everyone can make his, her own informed choice, which is what ultimately will shape the internet, not the technology, but the uses of the internet by informed, deliberate people. This book starts from the recognition of the importance and novelty of the internet as a medium of communication from many to many in a local, global, interactive mode in chosen time. At the same time, with a multiplicity of routes that make control difficult and favor horizontal communication. It is also multimodal, potentially linking, although not necessarily linking, communication modes of all kinds in an electronic hypertext. So it is an important new phenomenon. It is a new mode and medium of communication. Yet its fast development from 16 million the first year of the World Wide Web in 1995 to over 400 million at least these days, this development triggered all kinds of fantasies and hypes, futurologists and consultants, plus a distorted view of the new economy reduced to dot-coms. So against this media hype, the book attempts at reflecting on an empirical basis. Empirical basis that is not complete, certainly not, but at least I hope it's enough to indicate a style of hypothesis building and research. What is the outcome of this effort? Well, the main one, I think, can be summarized with the line, the network is the message. That is, what is really important, what is happening, is a major organizational transformation which characterizes all domains of society and economy. And this organizational transformation, networking, has found its technology. That's why, in fact, internet developed in the 1990s. Internet has been around since for 30 years, since 1969, and deployed, in fact, in 1970. And in fact, in 1970, the Defense Department in the United States offered it free to commercialize to AT&T, that studied for a few weeks the proposal with the best experts in hand and said no, no interest whatsoever, as John Norton has clearly documented in his History of the Internet. So the important thing, therefore, is that this convergence between an existing technology and the demand and projects from the society and from the economy around the idea of networks, around the practice of networks. Networks are an old human practice, had been in history for a long time, but the networks always had a great advantage and a great problem. The great advantage was their flexibility and adaptability. Their great problem was the inability to actually master resources and focus on task implementation beyond a certain level of size and complexity. Well, precisely new technologies, and particularly the internet, provide the possibility, the material possibility for networks at the same time to coordinate and centralize decision making and decentralize execution and decentralize implementation. So from this new networking logic, all kinds of things have happened, very much like during the formation of the industrial society, electricity and the electrical engine were the essential medium to distribute power throughout the economy and throughout society. In that sense, what has been critical in economic terms is the emergence of the network enterprise, that is, enterprises that are internally organized as networks, that connect to networks of other enterprises, and through a complex system of strategic alliances, make the actual operating unit in the business world not the firm anymore, but the project, the business project organized in networks of different firms at different segments of firms. The new economy, in fact, does not oppose to the old economy, grows from within the old economy, and diffuses throughout the economy worldwide through the global networks on the basis of competition that phases out less competitive systems of economic organization. Therefore, the new economy, as all new economies in history, is essentially about the substantial increase in productivity growth and in competitiveness for units, firms, and countries. However, this new rise in productivity, what we observe in spite of an inadequate statistical apparatus, does not cancel business cycles, does not cancel the need to expand markets at the measure of productivity growth, and does not avoid the impact of financial volatility. Financial volatility that has been prompted by globalization, deregulation, and the transformation of financial markets by computer networks, as we tried to show in our book on global capitalism with Tony Wilhatton and other collaborators. This particular networking logic is what is essential about the new economy, not the dot-com operation. All companies are becoming new economy companies or are being phased out by competition. This networking logic applies, as I have been trying to document in this book, to every domain. For instance, to the domain of sociability. In spite of all the myths about isolation and alienation as a result of the widespread use of internet, what empirical evidence shows is that, in fact, people who use internet have more sociability networks of all kinds than people who don't, with the exception of a couple of the studies that I discuss in my book. More than that, what happens is a transformation of sociability, a new pattern of sociability, the pattern of network individualism. What is essential in our society in terms of social interaction and social relationships is the emergence of individualism in terms of the building of sociability and in terms of the projects of people. In that sense, people do have sociability, but new kind of sociability, both physical and online, through networking to their selective partners in the world they want to build for themselves. This development of individualism that has been documented and analyzed by several sociologists throughout the world, including Ulrich Beck, is what really is behind the development of networking in the internet. Similar thing with geography. What we have shown through the doctoral dissertation of one of my students, Matthew Suk, is that internet is the most concentrated industry in the world, both in terms of the design, but also in terms of the content provision in the internet, the most concentrated one. So internet is at the same time a series of concentrated nodes of content provision in the major metropolitan areas in the world, at the same time network among themselves, constituting a new form of a space which is made not just of electronic circuits, but of major spatial concentrations linked among them through flows of electronic interaction. Same thing with social movements. Social movements are being transformed these days by the connecting capacity of these social movements throughout the world. The relationship between local and global becomes essential for the new social movements. And the anti-globalization movement is largely organized around the internet. So the response to globalization is not simply people in their localities, but people in their localities connecting with each other, building their connections through the internet, and then acting on media events that are supposed to be the media events of the dominant elite to subvert the media event from domination to challenge to domination. And it also applies to war, by the way. I have a little section in the book because I was aware of some of the studies at the RAND Corporation in which the new strategy of the U.S. Special Forces, seeing the possibility of terrorist networks, was to develop the new strategy called swarming and building autonomous cells connected in networks through, I wouldn't say the internet because they're not the internet protocols, but through computer communication and satellite communication so that they become at the same time autonomous, decentralized, but highly coordinated. Internet also transforms the conditions of inequality. What was supposed to be the greatest instrument of development is at the same time, because of its ability to connect what is valuable and disconnect what is not valued, becomes a major tool for increasing inequality. And we have seen increasing digital divide both in advanced countries and in the world at large. Now, this digital divide has also to be qualified. Digital divide is not simply being or not being in the internet. In most advanced societies, internet is diffusing so rapidly that anyway, it's not even a prediction but an observation to know that from the current levels of about 40 to 55% in advanced societies of the population on internet, will rapidly evolve to about 65 to 75, depending upon countries, within the next 5 years. So at that point, internet is almost everywhere. So the ability to be connected to the internet is not a critical matter in terms of inequality. What happens is that the more you depend on internet connection, that is on the ability to process information that is on the web, and the more you depend on your educational and cultural capacities to be able to retrieve information, process it, transform it into knowledge, and this knowledge apply to your own purposes. At the level of the world, yes, at the level of the world, there's a dramatic digital divide in terms of the exclusion from the internet and from advanced communication technologies of a substantial part of the human population. I just landed this morning from South Africa after the first meeting of the Advisory Council on ICT and African Development to President Mbeki, in which, interestingly enough, were some of the biggest IT corporations in the world accepting the idea that an effort in terms of subsidy, not investment, has to be done to avoid the entire disconnection of a continent beyond the valuable nodes. So this idea of the new digital divide, which is both qualitative in our countries and quantitative, that is, switch off of the population, of large part of the population, from the most valuable tool of communication, this has redefined the terms of social inequality in our time. And finally, let me add one last line in the 2 minutes that I have left. Internet is based on a culture of freedom. In fact, it is an extraordinary story. Freedom, academic freedom first, although it was financed from the Defense Department, but the researchers were largely academic, and the internet did not have any military use for 25 years. It's an extraordinary story of freedom of an innovation from the hackers, which were critical in developing and transforming the internet, from the countercultures, from the communitarian cultures, that then later on led to the entrepreneurs' uses of the internet. Internet was not produced either by government or by business or by established business. A government funded some program that didn't know what to do with it, and internet was taken, appropriated, and developed by cultural innovators and cultural libertarians. So, in fact, governments always had been and still are very nervous about the internet. More about that tomorrow. Like my commercial, Robin, because my lecture tomorrow is about internet and freedom. But what is critical to say here is that if it is true that freedom is a value, it does not solve the social, political, or economic problems of humankind. In fact, our technological power, our internet, enhances both our values and our contradictions, the good and the dark side at the same time. So internet is based on a culture of freedom and enhances our freedom of communication. But this freedom can be used by the conquerors to conquer the switch off, by the exploiters to exploit people without defense of these new forms of exploitation. So internet does not solve our problems, but in fact faces us with our own contradictions. Thanks for your attention.
Well, I'm now going to call on John Norton to respond. It's probably we can do it from, everyone can respond from their chairs. Up here, we're in the old economy, not the new economy. There is a rigid 10-minute time discipline on everybody. So I ask all contributors to stick to their 10 minutes as rigorously as they can.
Okay, thank you. Well,
please let us know if you can't hear.
Please let us know if you can't hear.
I first met Manuel Castells when we were both on a symposium in Seattle about the social impact of the internet. And there were an awful lot of heavy-duty guys at this symposium, men in suits. I remember, for example, a presentation by Craig Mundy, who at that time was the vice president of Microsoft. And as he gave a really serious presentation about Microsoft's plan for world domination that particular day, I was struck by, and then he was followed, I think, by Manuel, and I was struck by something that Isaiah Berlin once said about there being two kinds of people, hedgehogs and foxes. And what came to me immediately was that the room was full of hedgehogs, except for one, there was a fox, and he was Manuel. And nothing I've seen since then of him has changed my view. It's a wily, cunning, somewhat devious, and very entertaining fox. Now, reading his new book is a sobering experience for those of us who think we understand the internet. For example, and I'm saying this with some feeling, because I wrote a history of the internet, and I failed to notice that actually the kids, the graduate students who wrote the protocols which implemented the internet, were of course all products of the radical counterculture, the student movement of the 1960s. I read Manuel's book late at night and started to wince, because I thought, this is so obvious, how did I miss it? And the answer probably is that A, I'm an engineer and he's a social scientist, B, I'm a hedgehog and he's a fox, and thirdly, he's more perceptive. Now, the biggest misconception I think we face in relation to thinking about the internet is that we forget that technology always exists in a social context. And one of the most useful things to me about this new book is that it escapes from that delusion that somehow you can talk about the technology and you talk about the internet in isolation from thinking about society. I have spoken more times than I care to mention in the last 2 years at absolutely futile, brain-dead symposia, which are always start with the question, given the internet, what are its implications for society, for education, for the LSE, for you name it? Tick here, I've done it. And the truth of the matter is, of course, that the internet is not a given. It exists, it was brought forth in a social context, which is the point that I was making about Manuel earlier on. It exists today in a social context, and it will be shaped by the social context in the future. So the question that we should always ask is not, how is the internet changing society? Or even, how is the society changing the internet? The truth of the matter is that we have to talk about the co-evolution of the internet and society. And one of the really refreshing things about this new book is the way in which that is its implicit stance. And I think that's one of the most valuable things about it. Now, the fundamental question from my point of view about the net is whether or not it is really a genuinely subversive technology. And what I mean by that is it, in a sense, like print? Is it something that really will turn the established order upside down? Or is it something that creates waves and simply is absorbed and changed and transformed and so on? Now, I've been in this racket a long time, and I remember in the early days of the net thinking really that we had all died and gone to heaven, because we had invented something which was beyond the reach of the established order. We figured that the established order was A, too stupid, B, too slow, and C, too lazy to actually do anything about this. It was going to undermine sovereignty. It was going to make a mockery of copyright. It was going to cause a lot of trouble for businesses of various kinds and so on. It was made in heaven. And for a brief period, that seemed to be true, because what happened when you looked at the response of the established order is that they fulfilled our wildest dreams. For example, in the United States, the Congress engaged in enacting really, really stupid, half-witted legislation, which within a year impaled itself on the First Amendment. So we thought, we were right. These guys are too stupid and too slow and too smart, and this really is a revolutionary technology and so on. I think that nobody who reads Manuel's book will suffer any more from that delusion. The truth of the matter is that we were simply dumb witnesses at the normal dialectical processes, by which I mean that a new technology arrives, it is initially subversive, it causes panic, it undermines the established order, and so on. But after a time, what happens? Guess what? The established order gets a grip on it. And the established order in this country, in the form of the ex-former Minister of the Interior, Mr. Jack Straw, and other liberty and freedom-loving folks like David Blunkett, already have a really firm grip on your email. And it didn't take them that long, really. And we're seeing the same process in the United States and in every other country in the Western world, and indeed in every other part of the world. And by the way, it's very interesting to note that Manuel's trilogy the great trilogy beforehand, has now been, he tells me, translated into Arabic. And I have this wonderful image of guys, the Taliban, sitting in holes in the desert, reading Manuel's previous trilogy, trying to figure out how to strike next to the United States. I'm doing my best. So the first mistake that people made, we made, was to think that somehow this technology was, in a sense, could be divorced from social context, was immune to control. I think that's wrong. The reason it's wrong is partly because we assumed that the architecture of the net was itself a fixed, a given, just like the architecture of the physical space that we're in here is a fixed and a given. And of course, we were wrong about that as well, because the architecture of the net is determined by computer code, and computer code is not, like bricks and mortar, like the laws of physics, immutable. It can be changed, and is being changed. The third mistake we made is that we thought that the forces, social forces that might seek to control and change the net would belong to the governments of the world. So we spent all our time looking at governments. And in fact, while we were doing that, we missed the real action, which was that the forces that are changing the net, changing its architecture and so on, are in fact e-business, first and foremost. Because e-business is creating a new architecture around the net, which has protocols for authentication, for identifying people, for tracking what they do and everything else. The whole apparatus that you need for Orwellian control has been delivered not by the CIA, not even by Mr. Jack Straw or Mr. Blunkett, but by Amazon.com and a whole range of other worthy enterprises. And we never saw it coming. But where e-commerce goes, believe me, the spooks are not far behind. And that raises a fundamental issue for me, which is that it goes back to an old question of whether or not our futures are bracketed between the visions or the nightmares of two writers, George Orwell and Aldous Huxley. Orwell, you will recall, thought that we would be destroyed by the things we fear, by Big Brother, by mass surveillance, by mind control, and so on. And Huxley thought we would be destroyed by the things we love, which in Huxley's case boiled down to the satisfaction of various appetites, or what we now call entertainment. And for years I wondered what was the answer to the question. Which of these two writers was right? Which nightmare is correct? And the problem from reading Manuel's book is that basically he says the real answer is even more depressing than that. It's that both were right. Now, I think that in relation to thinking about the net and society, one of the things I notice, and it depresses me greatly, is that in terms of public debate about policy, about the internet, and so on, there is a frightening lack of awareness of the importance of the phenomenon that we have to deal with, of its relative fragility, and of what kinds of nightmares, Orwellian and other scenarios, we could create if we get legislation wrong. And what I find is that, with very rare exceptions, and one of them is sitting next to me here, Jeff Mulgan, almost nobody making policy in the Western world at the moment on these subjects knows the first thing about any of this. And here I think academia has a role to play. For example, I believe that we now ought to have in every major university a program which we call Internet Studies. I'm campaigning in my own institutions for a diploma in Internet Studies. And if I succeed, the one thing I can say is that one of the compulsory set books will be The Internet Galaxy. Thank you.
I'm now going to turn to Jeff Mulgan for his strict 10 minutes.
Right, well, I'm so glad to be here, because I've always been a fan of Manuel's ever since I did a PhD in the late 80s, not here, I'm afraid, very much on the issues of the network society and the ambiguities of power, which arrive from technologies which both empower large organizations and empower everyone else. And Manuel's been one of the very few people who, in his writings, has dealt with those ambiguities and not fallen into the trap of either seeing technologies as simple forces for freedom or as simple forces for an Orwellian nightmare. And they aren't. They're much more complicated and much more interesting than that. What I found striking reading this book is that although most of us now take the net absolutely for granted as part of our everyday life, it's a reminder of just what a bizarre phenomenon it is in many ways. Bizarre in that it is probably the only truly revolutionary technology most of us will experience in our lifetime, though some of the biosciences maybe. Bizarre in that it was a set of technologies which were imagined long before they came into being. And in the book, Manuel mentions Vannevar Bush. Some of you may have read his book in 1945 on the Memex, which actually foresaw a remarkable number of the things which then came into being around the net. it's remarkable because it does exist, again, as this book shows, as much as a culture and set of subcultures as it does as a business and a technology. And it's remarkable because of its interaction with the other phenomenon which Manuel described, which is the shift in the balance of social organization away from large centralized bureaucracies able to marshal resources and organize tasks towards networks. But it's a shift which is quite a complicated one because large centralized organizations are able to take on some of the properties of networks and actually respond to that challenge, which is why some of the earlier forecasts weren't borne out. What I think is less usefully done in the book is a sense of how open the future evolution of the net is. And here I very much agree with John. I actually think that although the speed of change remains remarkably fast, the speed of onset of the next generation, of WAP and so on, in many ways, the speed with which the net is transforming society is probably not much faster than the speed with which previous fundamental technologies like electricity or the internal combustion transformed our society. And the reasons are probably the same ones, that most of the barriers are not particularly technological ones, they are about the social and organizational innovations you need in order to make use of those technologies. So cars needed supermarkets and suburbs and garages and driving schools. Electricity needed radically different ways of organizing offices and factories before the full effect on the economy and society could come into being. And I think we're still in many ways at quite an early stage. It's more than 40 years since the invention of the semiconductor, 30 years since the TCP/IP protocols, and yet I wouldn't be surprised if 20 years from now the nature of a debate of this kind would be almost completely different from the debate we will have this evening. That we're still in many ways in an immature technology and an immature debate around it. And just to give a few examples of that where I think the situation is very fluid and very open. We still don't have really viable business models for using the net. We probably do in B2B, but certainly not in B2C, which is remarkable. We still don't have viable models of property rights. Michael Jackson's new album is attempting a new technology for securing his property rights over his music, but this remains an open phenomenon. We don't have a settled view on content regulation. All the pioneers believe this must be a wholly unregulated zone, but in many other countries there are legitimate arguments that families and children need much more structured protection from what they may come across in the net. And again, the other side of the channel, people will say what enters the home should be a fixed menu of sites, not the open access which we believe in. And it's quite possible that a few disasters with paedophiles could transform the tone of debate in this country as well. We don't know what the role of the public sector is going to be. Will the net be necessarily a force for privatisation, or will we actually see a new age of confident public services? I actually think NHS Direct is one of the great steps forward in public services for many decades, and is only conceivable in the era of the net, and yet we hear very little talked about that. And we haven't sorted out the basic netiquettes, the etiquettes of net use. That's true in relation to just sending emails to other people, but it's also true in very specific circumstances, like a very interesting innovation in this country at the moment, Care Zone, a website for children in care, which is trying to invent what are the protocols, both for children in care, talking to other children in care, but also for protecting them from paedophiles. So in these and many other ways, I think much that involves the net is very open. And I think that applies even more to the role of the state and of government. Manuel cites the remarkable fact about the net, which I think he says that every single technology associated with the net was actually supported and driven forward by governments, usually the US government, but as he also says, not deliberately, it was more that they were being rather effectively manipulated by a small group of computer scientists who had a rather idealistic vision of where the net would go. And what's surprising is that Manuel said that governments are very frightened of the net. Bits of governments are quite frightened of the net, but most governments aren't frightened of the net and are actually falling over themselves to promote it, to raise household penetration rates, to provide new services and to subsidise it in different ways. The problem is that although some of the impacts of the net on governments are fairly clear-cut, borderlessness, the difficulties in dealing with new kinds of risk and threat, many of the fundamental issues remain unresolved. And I just want to mention four, because I think these are some of the issues which the internet studies faculties should be looking at and which I didn't feel were adequately dealt with in the book. I mean, one is simply the economic impact of new infrastructures. We've had a lot written and said over the last 20 years about the nature of a network economy, but it's remarkable how little is really understood still about the impact of, for example, broadband or the next generation internet on the economy. And consequently, whether as a matter of public policy, it matters to encourage a more rapid take-up of those technologies or not. Lots of good analyses of railways and roads and electricity and indeed of past telecoms technologies, but quite a lot of unclarity there. Secondly, the issue of taxation. For the pioneers of the net, it was an article of faith. The net should be a tax-free zone. This was part of its nature as a realm of freedom. But quite patently, clearly, you can only support that the new economy is untaxed if you're also quite relaxed about having declining public services and a declining role for the public sphere more generally. And this is a debate which governments and academics are quite nervous of opening up, but it will be more and more fundamental as the net becomes a key zone for commerce. Thirdly, whether you want the net to be a free zone in relation to privacy and surveillance, issues which John mentioned. I think there is a legitimate position which says it should be, just as there's a legitimate position which says nobody's phone should be tapped, nobody's letters should ever be opened. But you have to accept the consequences of that position, which is that far more empowerment will go to organised crime, international terror networks who are already using the pretty good privacy software, than it will go to the ordinary citizens of the world. And fourthly and finally, you can want a policy-free zone, you can want the net to be driven forward primarily by e-business, as I think it has been, as John said, but only if you're willing to accept the consequences of possibly a much more divided society, and divided not solely, and Manuel is right on this, in terms of who has access and who doesn't, but who is actually a player and a participant in many other more fundamental ways. To summarise, I think we've seen in the last few years, we've seen a wonderful bubble blow up, and then we've seen it burst, both economically, but to some extent in the debates around the net as well. In the wake of that, it's easier to see what is a rather slower, more steady progress of radically different ways of organising the economy, radically different ways of organising the society. And in a way, I think we're now at the moment where the debate has to get more serious and more real, because what's left behind after the bubble has burst are some pretty old questions about the balance between equality and inequality, between freedom and order, and about the relationship between the state and the citizen. Questions which actually the net has not in any way fundamentally changed.
Well, you may think Tony Blair runs the country, actually Jeff does, and it's good to have someone so intelligent and clever in that position. I now turn to Roger, who's mysteriously gone to the podium.
Well, he's an academic and needs a lectern to protect himself from everybody else. I also hope that I can be heard. I want to preface my remarks by saying how much I've enjoyed reading Professor Castell's book. It seems to me to be remarkably sensible and level-headed. Perhaps what I liked most about it was the sense of struggle that it represents, and I mean represents in two dimensions. The book represents a picture of a relationship between the technology, as John Norton's already pointed out, the internet, and society, constantly in tension. The internet is a social product with its own social history and its own social dynamic, vulnerable both to the activities and desires of its users, large and small, corporate and individual, and at the same time, continually working those users over, massaging them, grinding them down into a new kind of social, political, and economic pulp, creating and closing down opportunities at the same moment, changing everything but itself, also constantly changing. So much so that the internet is here to stay, but its precise future remains uncertain. Jeff has just made that point. It is a view of the world and of the internet which I broadly share. But there's a second dimension to the struggle. The book itself represents an inner conflict, both profound and unresolved. In writing about the internet and about the network society, Professor Castells is like Jacob wrestling with the angel, or maybe the devil, or maybe both at once. Somehow the internet must be tamed. Isn't this what books of this kind should do? We should be able to know it, to understand it, and through that knowledge and understanding, we should know how to control it intellectually and then economically and politically. This is his struggle. It's a profoundly moral struggle in which the core questions of responsibility, trust, and our relationship to each other are raised, but then, perhaps inevitably, submerged by the pressure, the weight of his resistant but resigned acknowledgement of the regressive individualism of modern society, the weaknesses of government, and the alienation of citizens. The question asked but not yet answered, arguably it's not even answerable, is how best to live with this machine, with this everywhere, nowhere, omnipotent, impotent, empowering, disempowering, wealth-creating, impoverishing, connecting, disconnecting, social, antisocial technology. It's this question, however, that I want to address in the remaining few minutes I have to do so. I begin with Professor Castell's own first sentence in the book. The internet, he says, is the fabric of our lives. And I want to ask, as indeed he does too at the end of his book, who are we in this context? In what senses does the internet allow us, the all of us to which he refers, to live our lives together, and in what ways does it get in the way? Answering such a question involves challenging the singularity of the collective pronoun, the terrifyingly inapposite and misleading we. If it has done nothing else, and of course it has done plenty, the tectonic shifts in global political and moral culture that emerged with such horror on September the 11th have made that word almost inadmissible. The fault lines of global culture are now there for all to see, and no amount of technologically induced arm-waving and ingathering will disguise the real differences that are now scarring the face of civil society. Where does the internet fit into this new but old world? I want to make 3 points. The first is to say that it makes no sense to abstract the internet from other communication and information technologies, both old and new. Not only is communication now a matter for the convergence of traditional broadcast, telecommunication, and computer-based technologies, both fixed and mobile, but information is something that passes seamlessly both from one technology to another and into and out of mediated and unmediated space. Most specifically, however, the various media, which many but by no means all of the global population have access to, provide a dense, singular but intensely contested representational universe in which images and meanings fly from one corner of the globe to the other, respecting neither national nor technological boundaries. Lest we forget, television, broadcast television, satellite television, is watched by many, many more people than go online. And as such, it is television which still sets the terms of reference, enabling and disabling agendas, framing stories, encouraging belief and disbelief. For those that have access and the skills and competence to use that access, the internet is an additional resource, functional in all sorts of respects, but not yet a substitute for the still dominant technology that mediates both the pleasures and pains of life in the 21st century. Secondly, I want to lock the internet much more firmly into the texture of the experience of everyday life, for online and offline worlds are intimately connected and only gain their meaning in their relationship to each other. It is precisely this which allows us, indeed requires us, as students of the media, to analyze how the messages, the information and communications can be read, understood, and acted upon by different people in different contexts. These messages have human beginning and end points, and as such they are eternally vulnerable to all the fallibilities and anxieties of everyday interaction, magnified, it might be said, by the absence of direct face-to-face contact. I can cite current fears about the secret codes that may or may not be present in the Bin Laden videos as a particularly dramatic and immediate example of this fallibility and these anxieties. The uncertainties that academics feel, and we are extremely uncertain, when confronted by new media, is replicated a millionfold in the hesitant, alternately embracing and rejecting of them in ordinary life. And it is here in the daily round that the countervailing forces of ethnicity, geography, gender, generation turn all generalizations about global media power and shareable community on their head. There are, as it happens, other things in life. And thirdly and finally, to the hardest question. It is the question of distance. There is a common belief, and to some extent I think Professor Castells accepts this belief, that these new media, the internet especially, transcend distance. They bring us together in previously unimaginable ways through the speed of information transfer and the immediacy of the live image. We are confronted now in the so-called advanced societies by a relentless and continuous representation of a world to which otherwise we do not have access. We seem to believe that these images are both necessary and sufficient to enable a new kind of connection, a sharing and an understanding of the experiences of others, and that as a result, and by some magic transposition, we become global citizens. Distance no longer rules, and as Marshall McLuhan might once have said, there is a common belief that these technologies really do allow us to reach out and touch someone. Let me suggest that the internet, far from transcending distance, only redefines it. As such, it forces those who have access to it, as well as to global television, to confront a new and urgent moral agenda, in which our relationships to each other and responsibilities for each other will have to be radically re-examined. Re-examined in the light of what I might call the illusion of connection. Such a re-examination requires that both individuals and states find ways of recognizing and understanding those different from themselves, and to see that those differences are more than image deep. There is resistance. In the profound shadow of September the 11th, this has become hugely urgent. It is an agenda to which Professor Castell's book marks the beginning of a contribution, but I'm sure he will be one of the first to admit that there is still a huge amount of work to be done. Thank you.
Now turn to David, who's also going to the podium. This is a new custom building up here.
I'm going to the podium, Chairman, for two reasons. One is I feel safer if I'm standing behind Professor Castells in terms of what I'm going to say. And the second is that I am, I feel, in a sense, the interloper this evening. I'm the man from industry, the man indeed from the media industry. And amongst these distinguished academics and representatives of government, I feel a little vulnerable and better with my back towards the wall. Oh, thank you. Like the other speakers, I have drawn a huge amount of nourishment from this book. And I've drawn it, I think, because after 20 years of studying media marketplaces and digital change in media marketplaces, in the dot-com bomb, I and many others began to despair of whether the media would ever make any sense of all of this. Professor Castells offers us hope. It seems to me that in two areas of the book, he puts forward some arguments which we can grasp and take issue with, but which are very important in driving this whole thing forward. And those two areas are really about convergence, and I think I would probably take issue with Roger's remarks about convergence, but also about publishing and personal publishing. It does seem to me that we are reaching a point now where we're beginning to define this internet adventure in ways which actually block out a lot of what traditional publishing does. Professor Castells talks about a communication medium with its own logic and its own language, but it's not confined to one particular area of cultural expression. It cuts across them all. I think I agree wholeheartedly with that. He talks about the use of the internet as a communication medium being woven into the multidimensional practice of life. And then, startlingly, it seems to me, we have in sharp contrast the media and the markets that we're familiar with. We have the shocking contrast of the one-dimensional nature of much of the media expression that we have around us, and the fact that much of the media activity now being transferred into the web is format-driven. And what a sadness it is to see newspapers, magazines, books trying to replicate themselves in format terms inside the internet. Surely this environment was not intended for that. And isn't it a truth that much of the internet news nobody would ever pay for? Internet-based magazines have by and large failed. The e-book may be a transmission medium, but is certainly not yet or by any means an original publishing medium. And Actually, if we look at what is really happening on the web, we see that the internet is being used for transmission. Professor Castells, in his book, makes a strong point about local radio and the revolution wrought there. It's very important, but it is actually about a wider transmission network, about distribution. The music marketplace is involved deeply in alternative distribution, nothing more or nothing less. Copyright may be dead, but copyright can be reinvented in technological terms, and will be, in a new set of protocols in the internet space. And of course, it's a marketing revolution. Even if Amazon.com were to fail tomorrow, it would have revolutionized marketing of books in certain sectors of the marketplace. However, those are nothing to do with original publishing. Those are nothing to do with the use of the internet as an original medium. And it does seem to me that the convergence, which we keep on talking about, far from happening, has singularly failed to happen. That convergence in media terms is far, far away, and leads me to the view that we are right at the beginning of the use of the internet as a communication medium, as a publishing environment. We're not anywhere near yet the start. And then we come to this idea of personalized publishing. Professor Castells talks at length about the internalized hyperlinking environment. And I think he puts forward some very, very interesting arguments there about the way in which we are going to use hypertext linking in order to recreate linked communications. I can see those things just beginning, little seedlings already in media marketplaces. I see them in some law practices. I see them in some corporate intranets. I see people using these techniques to isolate the know-how of companies or groups of individuals and to link that know-how widely to disseminated, distributed data across networks. And in that acorn, in that essence, it seems to me that we begin to see a personalized publishing building out into a corporate publishing. But just a minute, these people are not publishers, these corporates who are doing this work, these scientists who are doing this work. Terrific examples in the hard sciences, in projects like PubMed Central or eBioSci in the European community. These are not publishers, but yes, they are. They are the next generation of publishers, because Professor Castells, it seems to me, begins on an argument which I feel ends with the ownership of acts of creation of media communication on the internet being in the hands of all of us. The specialized nature of media publishing is beginning to disperse. What do we need to make that happen? Well, I've got four things that that I think need to come into play in order to make this arena work. First of all, I think we have to overcome the bandwidth issues that Professor Castells alerts us to. This is a policy matter. This is a government matter, but it's also a matter of corporate practice. And I do think that we must look strongly to corporate sectors and to the professions and to science, as they have been in the past, to be our leaders in this area. I think the second thing we have to recognize is that many of these new structures that are going to come into place are essentially monopolistic. In other words, when a community comes together around, say, a supply chain, there will only be one of those. That, too, will throw up real problems for society. What will we do with the competition ethic in such environments? I think the third thing that we have to do is to look carefully at the way in which we describe knowledge. We now have metadata, knowledge about knowledge, coming out of our ears. We have terrific amounts of generative activity on the internet to describe information. And yet we have no coherence. We have no structures. We have no commonality. We have no standards. And we are already moving, my fourth point, towards the next stage. When we've, when the W3 Council accepted the protocol for the resource definition framework for RDF, they were beginning upon the track of knowledge representation. And I think my fourth thing would be to suggest to you that that's where we're driving towards. We're driving towards the interlinking of knowledge packages, of concepts and ideas in network configurations. And when we reach that point, we will be at a new publishing. And I fear, unless, of course, we can persuade them to read Professor Castell's challenging book, and I hope they will, that many of my current clients will not be there to see that day. But a few of them, enlightened ones, no doubt Oxford University Press amongst them, will be. Thank you. Very good.
Well, I now turn to Robin for our last contribution, and then I'll ask Manuel to reply reasonably briefly, I think, given the time frame.
Thank you. I'm not standing because I want to be rude to you, Manuel. Forgive me for looking at your back. I'm standing because I'm the last in a row of panelists, and I want to get your attention. I, too, want to express my appreciation to Manuel Castells for your encapsulation of the many contradictory facets of the way in which the internet is being developed across the world. I was really particularly taken by your use of phrases like informed bewilderment and the logic of chaotic complexity, alongside your desire that the culture of hope in the future might be the ascendant culture after all. As Roger and some of the other panelists have said, many people are intensely engaged with the internet, but they're also intensely engaged with their lives offline. People are using email to send and receive assurances after the horror of the 11th of September and its aftermath. But the information and the misinformation that is swirling through the internet is also very symptomatic of a pervasive informed bewilderment about how our lives and the lives of others across the world can be made safe. Since the protection of personal safety is a fundamental social concern, it must be right to imagine that it is a primary concern also of our governance systems. And this is something that Manuel takes up in the book. So the issue that I'd like to take up is about global governance institutions that are attempting to shape the internet of the future. It's these kinds of public institutions, along with national governments, which Professor Castells argues should enact political change. This is necessary to ensure the internet's further development is consistent with a social order in which people are able to become responsible human beings. Manuel Castells in this book paints a fascinating picture of the cultures of the individuals who are involved intensely with the internet. You mentioned some of them in your talk at the outset, the meritocratic sorts of people, the hackers, etc. What I'd like to suggest, too, is that the cultures of policy institutions permeate the corridors of power where global governance is performed. I think we need a better understanding of this when it comes to the internet's governance. In the past few years, I've spent considerable time mingling with people in intergovernmental policy forums. The subject is usually in some way connected with the internet or with its underlying infrastructure. These settings have been set up by the United Nations and various commissions, the OECD, Commonwealth agencies, and organizations. The delegates generally are fashioning policies that are meant to influence how the internet is introduced into our lives. In these settings, people talk about the internet and taxation, the internet and privacy, the internet and access, the internet and cybercrime, the internet and the economy. I could go on and on, but several things about these discussions have struck me. These discussions are mostly about reducing complexity in society, reducing the risk that the social order becomes so chaotic that it is unsustainable. The internet is perceived in these settings as a major destabilizing factor. Often the internet is seen as having much potential for positive change, but this is, for most people, just out of reach. Another thing that has struck me about these discussions is the disconnection between the lives of most people on this planet and the lives of the policymakers in these settings. In these settings, there is a sort of institutional ethos. People appear to believe that the particular issue that's under discussion, security, pricing, taxes, or whatever, is the issue. They come to believe that resolution of a given issue will produce an outcome that fashions the next generation of internet developments in a way that is consistent with their social values. But more than that, they often also seem to believe that their solution is a universal solution that is valuable for all people everywhere, and mostly it isn't. Yet another tendency of delegates who participate in these intergovernmental settings is to generate enormous amounts of uncoordinated discussion and action relating to internet governance. This isn't really all that surprising if anyone knows something about how policy processes work, but it is very difficult to see, in this case, who really can do something to rectify what you describe in your book as the institutional, as our institutional and social underdevelopment, and I know you've used that term previously as well. When we move away from social science analysis and become active in settings where there is policy action, we find that the strategies of the delegates often have little to do with the internet, even if the subject is the internet. In addition, some delegates will have a complete unawareness of what is technically feasible or what the consequences of making technical changes might be. This is what was implied by John when he was speaking. Often institutional rules of the offline world are simply being transposed into the online world, recreating power hierarchies as this happens, and as you pointed out in your book. We see this happening all the time in debates about the next generation internet, for example. My point is this: a lot of the discussion about global governance for the internet is populated by people who divide into two groups or perhaps two cultures. One is comprised of those who learn about and understand the technical code, if you like, of the internet and have various views about its consequences. The other is made up of those who understand something about how formal institutions of the economy and politics operate. They take the internet seriously, but they have little, if any, understanding of the technical code itself. So my question to you is this: do you really see any spaces of opportunity for these two cultures, if you like, to become better coordinated in their efforts? What chance is there really that these policy actors will coordinate their actions into ones that are more consistent with an internet and a society that is more favorable towards improving the human condition? And if a lack of coordination and the fracturing of cooperation between governments around the world is the predominant feature, can these institutions really bear the burden of social responsibility for taking action, as you suggest in your book? I think it's really important from a social science perspective to look critically at who is representing whom in the corridors of power of the institutions that are expected to start the process of refashioning the network society. I'd like to stop there and thank you for a very, very provocative book. Thank you.
Well, Manuel has dutifully written all this down and he's going to make sense of it for you in about 5 minutes.
Thank you. I usually tend to write not to give answers but to raise questions, and therefore I am really grateful for this debate because that's exactly the purpose for what I work. There are many very pointed and interesting issues that have been raised which I will not be addressing because they pertain to two groups of matters that, for in terms of my personal decision, and nothing to be proposed in that sense. I'm already preparing that. I have taken, which is, one, I never talk about the future. Two, I never talk about any policy prescription. Therefore they go, but I think it's very relevant to do it, particularly the second one. The first, I mean, if you don't have any time to lose, do it. But but I will be addressing the different issues that had been presented, selecting in these 3.5 minutes left, in telegraphic sense, what I for me is most relevant. First, yes, internet as all technologies, social construction, more than ever, because since it is a communication and information technology, and this is the heart of human action, the way we use it transforms the technology. And this is what has happened already in the last 30 years, and this will continue to happen. So it's not internet impacting society, but this coevolution. But in this coevolution, frankly speaking, I think society impacts the internet more than internet society. And this is what actually the evidence shows. The issue of is the internet has subverted the established order? Well, it depends what we understand by that. If we say, unless we subvert capitalism, there is no subversion, then you are right. Internet does not subvert capitalism. On the contrary, dynamizes the current type of capitalism, because capitalism dynamizes itself. And for a number of reasons, in the last 10, 20 years, has reshaped the world in many ways, which now some of the consequences we are seeing now. But the way, which kind of companies, which kind of procedures, which kind of management and production systems have emerged in the last 10 years had made a completely different type of capitalism. And the same thing, I would say, with many, many dimensions of society. There are two parts of the establishment, two segments of the establishment that are almost untouched by the internet, empirically speaking, always. One is government. Even if people have emails and websites, but very little has changed in terms of the procedures, in terms of how government works, in terms of what the government decides, etc., etc. Second, and I know there are helpful and happy exceptions, such as Geoff Mulgan and other people around him. But again, this is the exception rather than the rule. And second, universities. Universities have been almost untouched by internet, and social scientists in general are completely indifferent to this internet technology. And beyond email, the interest in doing social research on internet or related issues, come on, there are serious things like postmodern theory to be taken care of. I think that the debate which is central in the internet between government and citizens is not so much if the internet can be regulated or not, but if it is necessary a particular type of regulation for the internet, rather than applying and implementing general prevention and general regulation of society to the specificity of internet. Why you have to define some crimes for the internet that cannot define in other terms. You know, here, the basic institutional matter is that the U.S. Supreme Court has twice declared unconstitutional systematic attempts by the Clinton administration to control the internet. And unless this changes in the future, and it may because of the current situation, unless this changes in the future, you can always go around the U.S. backbone anywhere in the world. So the direct control to internet is extremely difficult. What is in fact different is that you cannot control the internet. You can get the ISP people and either shut them down or buy them or threaten them. And therefore, increasingly, there is a tremendous development as a conflict, as a battle, to defend the free communication in the internet. For instance, in Spain now, the Spanish government is trying to control the internet. The response of some of the key internet associations in Spain, like Cryptopolis, had been to set up their web server, their IPS, in the United States, and from there continue to operate. So this is an open matter. Now, the key issue here is that governments in general tend to distrust their citizens, and then they talk about pornography. But in general terms, there is a tremendous gap of confidence between citizens and their governments, as provided in terms of the citizens by opinion polls and in terms of the governments for their actions. I was in the European Union's Information Society Expert Committee to try to understand all these matters in 95, 96, and 97, and the main attitude from government representatives was how can we control this thing, because this is completely changing the rules of ourselves. So I think that some people in the world have an enlightened attitude, but I would say as enlightened as the Chinese government, meaning how can we use the internet for increasing wealth and technological innovation while still controlling the citizens, because that's too dangerous the moment everybody starts connecting with everybody by themselves. The e-business matter and the relationship to the new economy and declining public services, well, I don't think that there is a contradiction per se between a new economy, an entrepreneurial attitude, technological innovation, and the welfare state. I do not think so, and with Tony we have been working along these lines for some time. Among other things, I don't think so because I just finished my latest book. It's a new one that you don't know. You don't know because it was published 2 weeks ago, but in Finnish. If you want, I can hand copies to you. it will be published in English down the line. What this short book with Pekka Himanen shows, that there is a Finnish model of information society, Finland, number one information society in the world, Finland, the most competitive economy this year in the world, according to the World Economic Forum ranking, the fastest growing economy in Europe behind Ireland in the last 6 years, innovation, you are all on mobile phones, and guess who developed them? Nokia is not a Japanese company, remember? So, and at the same time, it's a very strong welfare state, and by the way, 75% unionization rate, a strong welfare state which not only is not contradictory to the internet and to the new economy, but can be shown, and we have shown empirically, is the substantive basis for producing the human resources, the innovation capacity, university research, and the knowledge generators in the new economy. Because after all, the new economy is about information and knowledge. This knowledge usually is in human minds, and these human minds are usually connected to human bodies, except in California. And finally, to really be... One word on the fact that the copyright issue is being transformed completely in the internet. I think the Napster phenomenon was extremely important because, yes, Napster was closed down, but then Nutella and then Freenet and then many other things. No, I think David was absolutely right. The issue of copyrights, it's critical, but has to be completely reformulated with these new technologies. But not because the internet is there, but because there are millions and millions of people who know how to use the internet to do what they want and not to pay the copyright they have to pay. And that's the critical conclusion of my book. What internet does, because it embodies, this technology embodies some values, and these values are values of freedom and autonomy. Therefore, they deliberately built an instrument that maximizes freedom and autonomy. And therefore, anything that goes with increasing autonomy is favored by the internet. So it, to some extent, it doesn't determine anything, but extraordinarily enhances and favors the capacity of autonomy building. Not just freedom in general, but autonomy building, rebuilding society and networks and institutions around the projects of people. That's where the issue is. If we have a society that develops along the lines of human values that we can share, this will be translated into autonomy building and reforming the society from the bottom up. If, on the contrary, this becomes cornered into specific applications of what already exists, we will have a boring reproduction of society at large, very much like David described the uses of internet by the media. So, in that sense, would end with answering, which is related to this, the key question that Drawing raised, which are the chances of the connection between the spaces of cultural autonomy and freedom, et cetera, that people are developing in the internet for good or bad reasons, Nazis too, right? And the culture of the policy-making institutions. Well, this is the only thing that is not based on my data, but on my reading of history. But I think history always changes when the dominant elites don't have any other solution, any other alternative than to change, because the way they were conducting business for their great benefit doesn't work anymore. Maybe, as horrible as are the moments we are living through, maybe it's an occasion and an opportunity to actually have the policymakers deciding to change a world that definitely is not sustainable. Thank you.
Well, I'm really sorry, everybody, but we have to finish sharp at 7:30, so there isn't time for audience participation. But I didn't stop him because I thought it was a very good synoptic conclusion. He would have wanted to listen to it. Can I ask you to stay in your seats until Manuel and the panel leave the room? And in the meantime, can I thank the panel for their notable contributions, and Manuel especially for coming here tonight. Invite you all to come and hear Robin lecture on these themes tomorrow evening at 6:30. And it's been wonderful to have you here, Manuel, and we look forward to having you here tomorrow as well. Thanks very much again.